committee, or no, we won't. That's no, my committee. House Judiciary Committee at, what time is it? At 1:40 p.m. on April, what is it, the 6th today? 5th, 2006. And we have Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission giving us an overview, and then we'll hear House Bill 325, Post-Conviction DNA Testing. Members present, Representative Gruenberg, Cott, Coghill, Wilson, myself, Vice Chair Anderson, Representative McGuire, Chair McGuire is en route. We do have a quorum, so why doesn't, let me see what to do, who is going to present? I don't have a list for the Rural Justice Commission. Can they wave their hand? Oh, are you presenting it? The Attorney General. Wow.
Ready?
Yeah. Welcome. Head honcho.
You didn't mention the other illustrious guest we have. No, a former staff.
Vanessa.
Oh, I didn't see her. Vanessa Tondini. We talked about you yesterday about the dog napping.
The story that we never... I saw it when you guys were having a hearing. I saw... No. It was on TV again.
I can't have
in one of the previous judiciary hearings.
That's amazing. That's been Vanessa Tondini, former staff to Representative McGuire. Okay, go ahead, Attorney General.
We thought you were here to testify on that bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair. My name is, for the record, my name is David Marcus. I am the Attorney General for the state of Alaska. And I'm here this afternoon along with my co-chair of the Alaska Rural Justice and Enforcement Commission, Deborah Smith, who is the acting U.S. attorney for the Alaska District. Some of you may have known Tim Burgess. Tim Burgess was recently appointed to the federal bench, and we're very lucky that Deborah Smith has been designated as acting U.S. attorney, and very lucky also that she's agreed to serve as co-chair in that capacity of this commission. I'm very pleased to be before the House Judiciary Committee again, and very pleased that you allowed us this time to present this report of the Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission to you. We're going to divide the presentation up a little bit between Deborah and I, and then we also have a couple of other commissioners present today who would want to make some remarks, so we'll be calling on them after we make our formal presentation. With that, I'll introduce Deborah Smith.
Thank you. For the record, Deborah Smith, acting U.S. attorney. I'd like first to thank the committee today for taking the time to review the report and to provide us this time to give you an oral report as well. And I'd also like to introduce our other commission members who are here today. We have Wilson Justin, the Vice President of the Mount Sanford Tribal Health Consortium, and Commissioner of Public Safety Bill Tandusky. We also have with us Denise Morris, the President of the Alaska Native Justice Center, and as well as other staff members at the Alaska Native Justice Center that's provided the Commission with a great deal of logistical support over the last 2 years. Julia Meyer, Special Assistant, and Karen Bisser, who provided consulting to them throughout the report. Really would like to acknowledge all the time and hard work and commitment shown by the commissioners and all of the individuals who participated in this process over the last 2 years. I'd like to talk just very briefly about the history of the commission and the commission membership and the process that was followed to bring you this report. General Marcus will then cover the recommendation highlights and the recommendations that would impact state law. I'll talk just briefly then about the commission's future. I believe following that, Commissioner Tandusky and Commissioner Wilson will speak briefly and will be available to answer any questions that you would have after that. Or during the presentation, feel free to break in as well. The commission was created by Congress in 2004 and was charged with studying these four areas: law enforcement in rural Alaska, judicial services, the impact of alcohol importation and interdiction, and the impact of domestic violence and child abuse in those areas. The commission membership was appointed by law by the U.S. Attorney General. There is a federal co-chair, which the U.S. Attorney has filled, and State Co-Chair, the Alaska Attorney General, is directed to fill that. Our membership has included the Commissioner of Public Safety, as I mentioned, Bill Tandesky. The Alaska Municipal League is represented by Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello. There is a position on the Commission for an Organized Borough, and Ross Schaefer, Sr., filled that position. The Alaska Federation of Natives has a seat. H. Buddy Brown and Ethan Shutt filled that position. The tribal representative is Mr. Justin. The nonprofit Native Corporation is, that position is filled by Loretta Bullard, the president of Kowarik Inc. And the Alaska Native Justice Center position is filled by Gail Schubert, who is the vice president of the board of directors of the ANJC and is also the vice president of the Bering Straits Native Corporation. The federal court system is represented by a non-voting member who is James Torgerson, an attorney with Heller, Ehrman, White, and McAuley. The Alaska Native Justice Center did provide us with our logistical and administrative support through this period, and we hired various experts on a contract basis. UAA prepared a bibliography of research, for example, and the commission is in the process of hiring a special assistant to provide technical support for future work. The way the commissioners decided to tackle this mandate, to look at those four broad areas and report back to the Alaska legislature and to Congress, was they began meeting in October of 2004, and they established working groups that met from January to April of 2005. Public hearings were held throughout the state from January to June of 2005. And then the recommendations made by the working groups and the various options proposed by the working groups were considered by the commission and synthesized into the initial report and recommendations that you have before you today. The working groups were limited to about 50 members total. They were a combination of experts in the various fields of concern, as well as residents in rural Alaska. They were formed by topic area. Commission members chaired them, and they met. They put a lot of effort into the various options and recommendations that they put forward. The public hearings we held mostly in rural locations. On occasion, they were partnered with prominent organizations, and they were recorded and transcribed and reviewed by all the commissioners. They were attended by most commissioners as well. These next two slides show you where various public testimony was taken, and both the organizations that were invited to provide testimony and did provide testimony, as well as the locations where the public testimony was taken. General Marcus will now walk you through some of the recommendation highlights in the final report.
Thank you, Deborah. Mr. Vice Chairman, the working groups created over 100 options. The options the Commission adopted were organized then into 9 general recommendations, many of which the Commission adopted and are encompassed in this report that we present to you today. The Commission's 9 recommendations are listed on this slide. I won't go through those recommendations because I'm going to go through them one by one. We'll start with the first one, which is to engage in more partnering and collaboration. One of the most significant outcomes of the Commission's work was engendering collaboration between a broad spectrum of stakeholders in trying to address the 4 issues before the Commission. Given limited resources and the daunting nature of the problems it was charged to address, the Commission urges more collaboration between the various governments involved. It specifically recommends collaboration on developing a number of agreements that could better coordinate law enforcement and judicial services in rural Alaska. For example, the Commission suggests that there be developed voluntary memorandums of understanding between tribes and the state regarding coordination and integration of child protection and domestic violence protective services. Another example would be the development of a state-tribal ICWA agreement. Also, as another example, we could have tribal-state partnerships on juvenile justice that could result in a DJJ referral mechanism. Responding to its first charge, the Commission offers several recommendations to improve law enforcement in rural Alaska, including the development of a statewide uniform and tiered system of certification and training for police and public safety officers with a reasonable opportunity for advancement that could culminate in qualifications to seek full police certification by the Alaska Police Standards Council. It further recommends expansion of police and public safety training, that further work be done toward cooperation in alcohol interdiction. The Commission recommends that state efforts be made to improve rural law enforcement. The state is currently undertaking many efforts to improve law enforcement in rural Alaska. For example, in fiscal year 2005, Governor Murkowski included in his proposed operating budget additional funding for 20 new state troopers and 6 new criminal prosecutors. Also, the Department of Law received a $2 million grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to create the Rural Prosecution Support Team. The team consists of 3 prosecutors, 1 victim witness paralegal, and 1 law office assistant, and will provide direct support to rural communities statewide, focusing on violent crimes, primarily in western Alaska, tied to alcohol consumption and abuse. As an aside, there are some alarming statistics. In 1997, 100% of defendants committing homicides in western Alaska had consumed alcohol. Alcohol was a factor in 66% of felony assaults, 62% of misdemeanor assaults, 54% of sexual assaults, 48% of offenses against minors, and 21% of sexual abuse cases involving minors. The Commission commends the legislature and especially Representative Dahlstrom for passing HB 398 in 2004, which authorizes the Commissioner of Public Safety and municipalities to establish domestic violence fatality review teams in cases of death or serious physical injury as a result of domestic violence. Commissioner Tandesky will want to address this further, but currently DPS is working at the state and federal level to implement a pilot project for village safety aides. The idea is to have a local resident working with a village health aide to provide very basic public safety services, such as water safety, fire safety, curfew, animal control, suicide prevention, DARE program, etc. This is not intended to be a law enforcement program and would be for small villages under 400 population. We are in discussions with federal authorities to obtain authorization to use existing appropriations in this matter. Additionally, the FY07 budget process will have this concept addressed in the conference committee. The Commission urges state efforts to address alcohol importation and interdiction. The Commission concluded that further cooperation between the state and federal governments is necessary to enhance drug and alcohol enforcement. Specifically, the Commission found that the lack of adequate Postal Service investigator staffing in Alaska is a significant impediment to alcohol and drug interdiction in rural villages, and recommended that the DPS should target alcohol and drug enforcement areas that include local option villages and their hub communities. It is also recommended to seek cross-designation authority for drug and alcohol investigators assigned to the target area, as well as statewide major offender unit personnel. In direct response to the Commission's recommendation, Commissioner Tandesky met with the Postal Service leadership in Washington, D.C. earlier this month to discuss this concept. He may want to add to my comments, but he reported that we are not yet where we want to be, but the Postal Service is stepping up their involvement. SB 170, sponsored by Governor Murkowski and passed by the legislature in 2004, was the most significant crime package to pass the legislature in 8 years. It provided many significant improvements to local option and bootlegging laws. The Commission urges the enlargement of the use of community-based solutions. The Commission was impressed with the public testimony and evidence that demonstrated the importance and success of approaches responding to the immediate and cultural needs of the community that are locally driven. In this vein, the Commission recommends amending state statute to allow the Division of Juvenile Justice to delegate its authority to tribes to enable the sharing of resources with respect to tribal juvenile offenders, with other amendments to permit tribes to participate in juvenile proceedings and juvenile delinquency treatment. It further recommends expanded funding to help nonprofit organizations and rural Alaska communities develop new programs at the local level to increase prevention, intervention, and treatment of domestic violence and child abuse, and to develop community-based restorative justice reentry programs. Noting that housing Alaska's inmates in out-of-state facilities is a weak point in the state's correctional system, the Commission asked the Department of Corrections to explore other options, including working with Native regional corporations to keep inmates in Alaska. Also, to help reduce the amount of alcohol reaching dry communities, the Commission recommends the establishment of alcohol distribution centers, such as the one in Barrow, in damp hub communities, restricting alcohol sales to residents of those communities only. The Commission recommends that the use of prevention approaches be broadened. The Commission concluded that there are insufficient prevention approaches in rural Alaska. The Commission recommends expanding culturally appropriate programs to reduce the demand for alcohol in rural Alaska, starting with youth, linking youth with adults in healthy activities, and providing more information to schools for first-time misdemeanor alcohol drug-related offenders. Expansion should also include more education, prevention, and early intervention programs targeting domestic violence and child abuse in rural Alaska, as well as the development of new prevention curricula to be implemented in kindergarten through eighth grade, teaching respect, establishing interpersonal relationships, and including a component on healthy behavior and the importance of remaining drug-free. The Commission also recommends that we broaden the use of therapeutic approaches. Although there are a number of programs in rural Alaska that target the problems of substance abuse, domestic violence, child abuse and neglect, and sexual abuse, all of which are routinely tied to the consequences of substance abuse in rural Alaska, there is a great need to expand therapeutic approaches, as related in the following recommendations. Alcohol drug abuse treatment programs should be expanded in rural Alaska with a system of longer-term residential care in hub communities, including programs for women with children, matched with a network of aftercare services in rural villages. Substance abuse, mental health, and dual diagnosis treatment options for youth also need to be strengthened, as well as therapeutic courts and group homes for children in need of aid who are not appropriate for or unable to access foster care. By changing regulations to allow close relatives caring for children in need of aid to receive the same level of financial reimbursement that non-relatives now receive, the availability of care in rural Alaska could be greatly expanded. The Commission recommends the increase of employment of rural residents in law enforcement and judicial services. In the face of significant overrepresentation of Alaska Natives from rural communities who encounter legal problems with law enforcement, and an even greater overrepresentation of Alaska Natives in the correctional system in Alaska, there is a great and growing need to recruit and employ Alaska Natives in these systems. Noting that modeling is important in rehabilitation, as is cultural identity, the Commission recommends the implementation of a focused recruitment effort to bring more Alaska Natives
and other rural Alaskans into the correctional law enforcement and public safety workforce. It also recommends increasing the training and utilization of village public safety officers as probation officers in the villages and contracting with tribes to oversee community service work, which would increase the supervision of offenders on probation and parole in rural Alaska. The Commission reviewed a multitude of indicators that pointed to the relative lack of infrastructure to support police and public safety functions in rural Alaska, which in turn has a detrimental effect on recruitment and retention of officers. So the recommendation is to build additional capacity. Specifically, the Commission recommends improvements and expansion in housing for police and public safety officers, increased availability of appropriate intra-community transportation, more law enforcement offices and holding facilities in rural Alaska, and improved law enforcement equipment. The Commission and the Department of Public Safety recommended that these improvements could be accomplished by constructing multi-purpose facilities with an apartment, an office, and a holding cell for the troopers in larger underserved village locations. Troopers who are currently assigned to hub communities would be reassigned to these new posts in what we call sub-hub villages and would work at these locations on a rotating schedule. This concept exemplifies community-oriented policing and has many benefits, including reducing response times and providing a significantly enhanced law enforcement presence than has been possible in the past. The Department of Public Safety is already making progress and is about to implement the sub-hub concept in Cold Bay using existing housing and will proactively provide services to Perryville, False Pass, and King Cove. They're also looking for one or two other West Coast areas to test this concept. The Commission also recommends improved and expanded training and the development of standardized statewide data systems to document and monitor law enforcement investigations in rural Alaska. The Commission recommends an increase in access to judicial services. The Commission found that residents of rural Alaska do not have access to sufficient civil legal assistance to redress legal problems related to domestic violence and child abuse, and recommends enhanced funding to respond to this need. The Commission also recommends that Congress restore federal funding opportunities for tribal courts located within the boundaries of municipalities. It also recommends the increased use of tribal courts and video conferencing capability, along with training and technical assistance to judges and support staff in the Alaska court system and in tribal courts to inform and instruct participants in both systems to be aware of and value the cultural differences in rural Alaska. The Commission recommends the expansion of the use of new technologies. Alaska enjoys the most sophisticated telehealth system in the world, the Alaska Federal Health Care Access Network. But in the hundreds of rural Alaska villages that are incorporated into this network, other organizations do not have access to the already in place broadband capabilities that are available in their community. To remedy this situation and improve communication within law enforcement and judicial systems in rural Alaska, the Commission recommends changing current regulations to allow rural police, public safety officers, and the courts to utilize this bandwidth. The Commission also recommends that the Department of Corrections explore the use of new electronic monitoring technology utilizing the global positioning system for rural Alaskan probationers, and that the Alcohol Beverage Control Board develop a statewide database for all alcohol written orders for the new community distribution centers. The Commission has additional recommendations impacting state law. Most recommendations impacting state law will have at least minor fiscal impacts, and thus the Commission respectfully asks for your support. As Senator Stevens echoed several weeks ago in his address to the legislature, both state and federal funding should be sought to implement improvements needed for Alaska, which include the Rural Justice Commission's suggested recommendations. Senate Bill 210, sponsored by Senator Theriault, and Representative Myers' House Bill 373, incorporates several of these important recommended changes in Appendix H of the Commission's report that will help law enforcement better protect communities that have chosen to limit the sale or possession of alcohol under local option laws. Currently, more than 100 communities in Alaska have chosen a local option to combat the problems associated with alcohol abuse and violence. Senate Bill 210 strengthens current forfeiture provisions in statute by allowing a seizure of alcohol transported by common carrier in violation of current law. It authorizes the seizure of property determined to have been purchased or obtained through the proceeds of illegal importation or sale of alcohol, and outlines procedures for a person claiming an interest in property that has been seized. SB 210 defines manufacture of alcohol and provides consistency between the statutes by amending the allowable quantities. The legislation also clarifies statutes relating to the presumption of possession for sale. The Commission gives its full support to this legislation as the provisions it contains will provide clarity and assist law enforcement and communities in their continued interdiction efforts in damp or dry areas of the state. SB 210 has passed the Senate, and we understand it is currently in the House Rules Committee awaiting action on the House floor. Other Commission recommendations, including banning written order sales and the shipping of alcohol by plastic by air to dry towns, and changing the regulatory definition of a village from 1,000 to 1,500 individuals. At this time, I'll turn it over to the U.S. Attorney to talk about the Commission's future.
Thank you. Originally, the Commission was tasked with considering those four broad areas and reporting back to the legislature here, as we're doing today, and to Congress, which we will be doing sometime next month in Washington, D.C. As the commissioners looked at these problems and the various pilot projects suggested and the various changes suggested, we realized that writing the report was probably the easy part. What was going to be much more difficult was a follow-up to see if these could be implemented. The commission recommended to Congress that the life of the commission be extended, and Senator Stevens has indicated he will seek additional funding to permit that to occur and is supportive of that idea. We also realized that we needed to expand representation on the commission to adequately address the issues and determine the success of some of these pilot projects. We are proposing that the Commissioner of Health and Social Services for the state of Alaska be included, as well as a representative of Alaska Native healthcare providers and a non-voting state court representative to be appointed by the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. Those recommendations are pending now with the U.S. Attorney General. What the Commission sort of determined would be necessary to move forward with implementation is to continue the dialogues with all the stakeholders in rural Alaska, as well as the perhaps most important, monitoring the development and implementation of some of these recommendations, conducting some additional research, and then evaluating the impact of the new and expanded activities and reporting back on those as well. To accomplish all that, I think the Commission recognized our objectives are to advocate at state and federal levels if additional legislation is needed, for example, or funding, to educate and get buy-in from all the various stakeholders and from the public, and to advocate for expansion of innovative prevention, early intervention, and treatment programs. The Commission realized that alcohol abuse and substance abuse is at the root of many of the problems that we see in rural Alaska, and endorsed the concept of trying to become proactive rather than just reactive in a law enforcement stance in addressing those problems. Also, to increase interest in the recruitment, training, and hiring of qualified Alaska Natives in law enforcement and justice areas, and then to further define the role of the Commission if that should become necessary. In addition to addressing the alcohol and substance abuse and all of these various objectives, I think the commission also realized it's imperative to seek solutions at the local level whenever possible. So we look forward to continuing this work, and I believe now we've planned, unless there are questions at this stage, we plan to turn over the floor to Commissioner Bill Tandesky and Commissioner Justin Wilson.
Are there any questions for the presenters? Representative Wilson?
Could you tell me how many villages will you pick up if you change the definition from 1,000 to 1,500?
You know, Bill?
That's for me.
That's for him.
All right. If you'll answer it when you come up.
I would just say that thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Dave, for and Commissioner and the other members. I think it's so instructive. Not only is this an assiduous report and instructive for us, but it enables us to have ideas for legislation, hence things like Roteberg and others, therapeutic courts, or Meyer's ban on certain sales of alcohol in last year he quoted the report and said, hey, this is where we got the idea from. And I looked down the idea of the sub-hubs and kind of the innovative ideas that the commissioners had, and we're working on state crime lab and DNA expansion, which is another bill separate from that. But I appreciate that you guys are so detailed, because I've worked on these reports before, not something quite this comprehensive, but it's difficult. And you had made a comment, you know, this is the easy part, but in a way it isn't, because it's so critical. And some of us read this line by line to figure out what to do. I won't be back again, but there's a lot of people that will spur ideas from this. And so I think most of us listen intently and are appreciative of what you've done.
Thank you.
After this year, Mr. Vice Chair, may none of us be back.
Sir,
please.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Tandesky, Commissioner of Public Safety, and I wanted to just kind of build on a couple thoughts that have been expound on what we are already doing along these lines. First, for Representative Wilson, right now I think we would only technically pick up maybe one village by the change in definition, and that would be Hooper Bay, which is now up around 1250. But there are several other villages that are knocking on the door of 1,000, and we really don't want to get into a technical by regulation, we shouldn't do this and that. When nothing else has changed other than a population. And so that's why we're addressing that. Quickly, if I would have had the opportunity to change the title of our group, I would have said Alaska Rural Justice and Public Safety Commission, because I make a distinction between public safety and law enforcement.
Is that a motion, Commissioner?
I beat to Senator Ted Stevens. because I think that part of the solutions that we talk about really are not about law enforcement, they're about public safety. And there are a lot of things we can do that are not true law enforcement that improve the quality of life and reduce the incidence of suicides and accidental deaths and all those kinds of things that we deal with in rural Alaska. So, but very quickly, some of the points that were covered: the Postal Service cross designation. We do not have a real willing partner yet in with the Postal Service. Senator Ted Stevens is very interested in this and is working on it. I did meet with postal officials 3 or 4 weeks ago in D.C. I do have a commitment where they are stepping up their efforts, and I think giving us a full-time postal inspector into our drug and alcohol efforts, which is a nice step forward. But it doesn't really get me totally where I want to be, where my investigators that are already in Bethel and Nome and Kotzebue, who can go into post offices in the village and interdict things when things are moving quickly. But we're going to keep working on that. We're making baby steps there. Pilot projects that we're talking about include the sub-hub concept. There's really two parts of that in my mind that I've proposed. One is for a more permanent structure, such as in either Savunga or Gamble, as an example, where I'm looking for federal dollars to build the facility that the Attorney General mentioned, where I'd have an apartment with an office and a holding facility, and then I can rotate troopers from other areas in and out of there, almost like on a North Slope schedule, two and two. And you'd be able to police all of St. Lawrence Island probably 80% of the time that way. Right now it's probably 5% of the time with my people. So looking for ways without having to ask people that I recruited out of Anchorage to move to St. Lawrence Island with their wife and kids, it's just not going to happen. How do I get the highest quality of law enforcement services on the ground and still accommodate recruitment and retention efforts? And I think we have got to get outside that box and try some things differently. So that's one of them. The other one was mentioned was Cold Bay, and we're looking for a couple others. We're working with Alaska Housing Finance that anytime they're going to build teacher housing or health housing in villages, we want to know about it, because we may want to get in on that project and have an apartment in a village. And by doing that, our first one was actually going to be Unalakleet, where we do have a housing unit from the Health Corporation. We turned out we found a trooper that actually wanted to move there and live full time, so that's what we did. But the idea was that we would take troopers out of Nome for a week at a time and shoot them into Unalakleet. They would work that pod of villages up there,
yes,
and
that,
keep
yes.
being proactive, not yes. reactive.
Definitely.
Not waiting for the assault, not waiting
that's
for
what I have here.
The death or whatever. Go in there proactively and work with the community.
Representative Berkowitz, are you listening to Commissioner Tandesky? This is very important, young man.
All I have now is a black belt. My most dangerous instrument. But so those are the two kind of things we're looking at. Now, what we're trying to do on some of these things like Postal Service cross designation are things that would make us far more effective. It doesn't cost you a dime. It just makes the current resources we have out there more effective. And so we're trying to do some of those kinds of strategies. The tiered training concept that was discussed earlier, I do have that on the agenda for the Police Standards Council meeting May 15th in Fairbanks, because right now VPSO training is under the Department of Public Safety regulations. Village police officers are under the Alaska Police Standards Council. And if, as I move to the pilot project of a village safety aide, who knows where they'll be. And so I think we need to get that figured out so there is some continuity in how we're tracking training and maybe allowing for progression. The I did meet or teleconference last week with federal authorities looking for more flexibility in federal appropriations that we've already received and that we will be receiving for federal or for rural justice initiatives.
And I'm going to interrupt there because that's a good segue. U.S. Attorney and Dave spoke about the funding, the federal funding, and you as the state commissioner deal with that and help facilitate that. Can you explain how we can assist, because I think the majority are supportive of this program and want to see it continue at a state level, and is there a partnership with federal or is it just funding from the U.S. Congress and Senate through Stevens, Young, and Murkowski?
Chairman, actually, I think we have a good balance right now. The VPSO program is supported by the legislature every year and has been for some time. What I'm trying to do is get away from just talking about VPSOs and talk about rural public safety as a whole, because if we rely on hence the pilot project for village safety aides, if we rely on it's either got to be a trooper or a VPSO, and you can't get either into a particular village, then they have nothing. And the analogy I used in front of your Senate counterparts this morning was the village health aid program, long established, I believe very beneficial for villages. If the notion was that we will accept nothing but a certified medical doctor or a physician's assistant, then the vast majority of villages would have nothing. And what I'm suggesting is, since we cannot get a certified police officer in every village, there are not qualified, interested people that can do that. And we can't get VPSOs into every village because there are not qualified, interested people. Sure. Then how about if we try, at least on a pilot project, something that you're more likely to get interest and participation at the village level, people that were born there, grown up there, want to live there, that can dovetail with the village health aid and do some proactive things that are not necessarily law enforcement, but rather there are so many things, whether it's curfew and animal control and water safety and fire safety and That individual could be the point person for Code Red for fire safety in the village. There are a lot of possibilities here. And again, I'm talking about existing funding, because we give back VPSO money on the state level every year, lapse because it's not used. We have a substantial amount of federal money right now sitting out there, but because it said VPSO on it, we get a little tied up there. What we're looking for from the federal authorities, and I believe we will be successful in getting more latitude in investing that money into the rural communities for something that I believe can help reduce suicides and accidental deaths and all those things we want to deal with. And I believe there are quite a number of smaller villages out there that would be thrilled to have the opportunity to try this program out. And I think it'll be popular, my opinion. But again, if we don't do something other than what we've always done, why would we expect any different results? So that's kind of the basis of what the Department of Public Safety is up to, and our thought is staying within the boundaries of state law, and because we do get into some things that my friend over here will talk about, that, you know, that we do get into gray areas on tribes and those kinds of things, and we do our best at the field level to work within those. But the programs that I put forth, I'm very careful to keep within the confines of the state constitution and what I believe my direction from you all are.
Any questions for the commissioner? Your presenters before you had pretty pictures. You didn't. I hope to God you have some pictures.
I have pictures.
Go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Wilson Justin. I'm with Mount Sanford Travel Consortium. I serve as the Executive Vice President of MSTC, but lately also have had to do dual duty as Acting President. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I served on the commission as tribal representative and had from the start. Before I put some general comments on a table in terms of the commission's recommendations and work, I'd like to go back to the about mid-part to the commission's activities when we had formed these work groups, about 50 work group members in total. The four work groups that were formed met weekly telephonically on teleconferences, and I served as co-chair on two of those work groups on the teleconferences, and we also sometimes had to do double and triple duty in terms of filling in for other commissioners. But the underlying point I wanted to make on that process is that there were plenty of people who represented nearly all of the important points of view, in my estimation, in the issues that we were undertaken to look at. We had attorneys who represented tribal perspective. We had attorneys who represented state perspective. We had attorneys directly involved with federal issues from the federal level. So in my estimation, the commission made a very serious effort at hearing all the perceptions and perspectives that were active statewide in this last few years on the issue of not only tribal rights, tribal sovereignty, state rights, state sovereignty, and federal rights and priorities. And I wanted to mention that because I wanted this committee to get a direct comment from the tribal representative here that we left no one out, in my estimation. We didn't argue these. We were not, of course, the Supreme Court. We didn't argue these issues extensively. For instance, one of the issues that's on everybody's mind in terms of the extent and reach of tribal jurisdiction and sovereignty, we elected as the commission to not approach that question, thinking that small steps is probably the best way to move these issues forward. Rather than have one giant battle at the beginning, let's just take small steps and move the progression and the issues forward in a positive way. So that primary issue, which is on a lot of tribal advocates' mind, is parked for the time being. There'll be a more serious look at it, in my estimation, down the road. So a lot of the issues that we did bring recommendations into focus for were by and large public safety issues or preventive issues, because the primary underlying issue in my estimation, whether it's a rural community or Alaska community, is alcohol and substance abuse. Everything is tied to those issues, whether it's domestic violence, whether it's children failing in school, whether you have family members that cannot get job and support the family. All those issues in a roundabout way tie into the general theme of substance abuse and alcohol issues. So I'll stop on the general perception of what the commission was doing and kind of move over into a couple of the arenas that Commissioner of Public Safety spoke to. I agree by and large with Commissioner Tandusky's assessment of how some of these pilot programs should work and can work in the communities, bearing in mind that the one particular program he spoke to, which is the Safety Aid program, was not an issue that had been discussed by the commission or the work groups and did not come out as a recommendation. However, as a pilot project, it's easy to support because it very, very much follows the model laid out by the Community Health Aid Program, and we all can acknowledge the success of the Community Health Aid Program statewide and nationwide. And this morning when I spoke to the judiciary counterparts in the Senate, I spoke to the Safety Aid Program saying that if you were to tailor that particular pilot project as proposed by Commissioner Tandusky in key competencies, particular cultural competencies, among other things, to fit and tailor those programs to the community that they serve, you would undoubtedly have success. That's the key in my estimation. You can't make people like what they intend not to like, just like you can't legislate morality or ethics. If a community rejects a particular program, there's no sense in trying to make them like it or point out to them that they should like it. And the issue with the safety, the issue with the pilot program on these safety positions is that it's intended, in my mind, to fit the community that those individuals are to serve. And that's a very critical component. Another general comment that I want to put forward for your edification is that, and I mentioned also this morning in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I do want to mention that a tremendous amount of money is returned from rural communities to, in particular, Anchorage, to a lesser extent Fairbanks, but in particular Anchorage. In our own particular case, the Mount Sanford Travel Consortium, about 80% of our funding level is recycled directly back into Anchorage. And I mention that not to create a perception that somehow or another something is wrong. I mention that particular number because I want it understood and on the record that in my mind, tribal organizations and tribal entities and nonprofits are prepaying for these prepaying the cost of these programs that are being put in place. It's like being pre-taxed. We're already throwing our 2 cents on a table for all of these potential solutions that are going to be proposed by the state legislatures and federal counterparts. And I think that's an important part to remember, that we're coming to the table already with a lot of help and support financially to the biggest community in the state. And that's something that I wanted to make sure that was part of the underlying discussion here, because you can use that kind of a financial discussion in many different ways. But I just wanted to make sure that it's understood that the issue is economic in part, and that makes for a different kind of discussion. It's political in part, which makes for a different kind of discussion. It's also in many ways social in part, which makes for a different kind of discussion. And as Commissioner Tandusky states, you can even differentiate between public safety and law enforcement at the very critical field or local level. So coming into this kind of a process, it's not automatic that you're going to produce an outcome with all the various kinds of thought process going on that's going to be good in terms of the long term. But I think this commission did an extremely good job of producing recommendations that will in generally fit the times and the era that we're facing. And I'll stop there and not take too much of more of your time and pause for any questions.
Representative Grunberg, then Wilson, and Chairman, Chairwoman McGuire's back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. This is a question for anybody on the commission. When the minority leader stopped in, he asked me to do something that I was going to do anyway. There are a number of bills that are around, most particularly, I think, Senate Bill 210 that's in the House Rules Committee. It was going to be on the floor. It dealt with alcohol. It was the equivalent of Representative Meyer's bill. And there have been some changes made to the House version relating to some of your recommendations. And what we would like to do, he and I would like, and I'm sort of deputized to do this, I think, to meet with one of your members to go over your specific recommendations to see whether any of your recommendations can be put into any other pieces of legislation. And they're going to be having a Rules Committee meeting on that particular bill. I'd like you, and I'm talking to either of the co-chairs or any of you, to deputize one of your members to go over this stuff with me for a few minutes, maybe even later today, so that I can carry that through. And I would just ask one of you to come up and talk with me so we can set a time for that. I just took this as an opportunity to...
You want to be paid double your salary if you have to meet with Representative Grunberg.
But it'll be double the reward.
Representative Wilson.
Oh, and I'm sorry, one other thing, too. You know, when Ms. Smith, when you came here, it's the first time in a long time that I can remember the U.S. Attorney or the acting U.S. Attorney coming to this committee. And Madam Chair, I know we have another bill that's somewhere on the calendar, but maybe if we finish a little early, I'd like you to come back and talk to this committee for a few minutes about things that are going on in your office that we might be interested in. Could we take a few minutes for that, Madam Chair?
Are you prepared to do that today, or would you like to come back to the committee next week? Or
we could do it either way. I could do it extemporaneously.
Okay.
We don't demand a script.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I want to commend the commission because in listening to this, I think you've looked at a lot of things that are really prevention, a lot of prevention things in here. And I think that funding for this state typically is at this end, which is the end after the bad things happen, then we try to deal with it. And so all of our money is kind of zeroed in on that end. And we have got to change that. We have got to start putting the money at this end so that those things won't happen, because it doesn't do us any good to just keep working at this end when we aren't doing anything at this end. So I really am excited about that. However, I do want to make the comment that it's a big mindset change for a lot of legislators, and a lot of legislators are having a hard time getting that concept, but I think it's the right way to go, and I'm real pleased to see it, and I'm hoping that we can definitely start making some inroads. Thank you.
Okay, and I note that Ted Popley's on the line. Ted, did you want to say anything? I see you're on the line to answer questions. Did you have any thing that you wanted to jump in and say?
No, Madam Chair, I'm just listening in and also available if there are any questions. Don Mitchell is unavailable for this hearing. He's not here with me. He had a hearing he had to attend.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Popley. Okay, questions? Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I was late. I appreciate the work you've done. I guess I would only have one plea to the extent folks agree with this, and I don't want to change your mind on anything. I know part of the recommendations is that we deal with prevention, that we deal with treatment and prevention so that people who are nonviolent criminals, those who have alcohol and substance abuse problems, get to be sort of returned to becoming productive members of society rather than jail inhabitants. And the way I see it, I think one of the shortcomings is that on a statewide basis, we don't have enough treatment available to those who need it. And anything that we can do outside of this building to help make that point, I think would be useful, because that's always going to be a roadblock. We can't get as many people into the therapeutic courts or the treatment courts if they don't have the money to get the treatment they need. That is a big component of the courts. So anything folks can do to sort of help us do more public education on that issue, I would personally appreciate. I appreciate the work of the commission very much, and very sympathetic to the goals.
If I could add just a bit of a comment to what Representative Wilson and yourself is alluding to, there's also one additional dimension that in the restorative justice activities out in the tribal communities, one of the activities that's being undertaken is to not so much prevention, but really to teach a community how to make amends with itself. Because some of the so much of our efforts in the past 20 or 30 years, and I'll be I'm in my mid 50s, so I had sometimes, I guess you would say, not so great opportunities to see a general breakdown of my culture and communities in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, pre-pipeline, post-pipeline, and during the pipeline days, and before that when the drug subculture hit the state of Alaska. So I saw things that children should ever be put in place where they should see things. Those kind of hurt and pain and trauma are still in place in communities today, and have a great deal of impact and influence on healing, which makes for very difficult, I guess you would call bridging the gap between having programs that heal people and having programs that put people back into their rightful place as leaders of the community. What we have is that trauma does not allow for us to make much progress. We have to learn to heal ourselves inside before we can move forward. And that's a direct hidden component that is not addressed in the commission's report, but which is an underlying theme. It doesn't make any difference really whether it's a tribal community, it's any community, any trauma. And in the long run, that's something that the state of Alaska, I think, needs to look at in terms of how do you assess and measure trauma in communities and be able to put programs together that allow for progress to happen without people constantly being suspicious of each other and tearing each other's best efforts down. And I just wanted to mention that, because I sensed in the entire commission proceedings for the entire year that we met and dealt with that. People wanted to say this but didn't know how. So I just thought I'd put it on the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Representative Coghill?
I think the fact that you said we're going to just look at the problem and then figure out if there's legal barriers, it was a good approach. So I appreciate that. I think it helped come up with some interesting suggestions, and I think the one about sharing quarters for public safety officers, I think, is good. I like the idea of doing some kind of training in the local area for local people who might be public safety officials of some variety. And so, as you have made that suggestion, have you extended further and to see in either one of you can answer this question, what that might look like in a community, what that might look like in state law. So is there, I see the suggestion, I haven't seen any development of it. Or is that something that we should probably take up and run with?
Commissioner? It's a lot, huh?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Coghill, I probably need a little clarification on what you're asking. Are you asking of what a I heard a question about training at the local level. That's something that my department is exploring at a couple levels now. That we have been training village police officers for, geez, probably 15 years. We're not mandated to do so, but we do it. We do those in hub locations, Bethel, done a number of them in St. Mary's, I think Kotzebue. I think we've trained probably 200 that I can, last number I saw. We are exploring whether or not at least part of VPSO training could be held in a regional hub, given that it's very difficult to take particularly individuals from villages and say, you get to go to Sitka for 10 weeks for a, kind of a paramilitary academy. The last academy we started in January, started with 18, we were down to 10 inside a week. And so looking for to keep folks engaged, so we're looking at some different alternatives. And so we're trying to be very flexible, and again, with pilot projects, to see what works. I'm certainly not locked into what we've been doing for a long time. I'm actually quite committed to getting off of that and onto something.
Is that something that we need to go to the communities and ask, or is that something that we need to ask? Because the VPSO is restrictive from the perspective that you came to in the commission. And has there been any request in the village of what that might look like?
Well, there hasn't been any specific requests, but I do know that, for instance, in Cake, where they work very closely with the magistrate down there in terms of some of the sentencing procedures, and they also do, in addition to that, training for their healing circles, which are part of the restorative justice activities that I alluded to. I know that CAKE has a high rate of success in a couple of critical fields. One of them is stopping suicides, and the other one is lowering domestic violence incidents. So obviously they've either designed something that is working very well or they're an anomaly, and my best guess is that they've designed something that shows that proper training works very well.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. It's been a long discussion around this legislature about restorative justice and trying to figure out, you know, how it would work in a smaller community over against a larger community. In a larger community, you have schedules and resources that you don't have probably available to you in a smaller community. So I think somewhere along the line, we're going to see how these two can get combined to make effective efforts. So I was just kind of fishing for that.
Thank you so much. This is really good. I apologize. I need to read through the recommendations, and I know members of this committee have expressed an interest in the results of this. So thank you for coming forward and presenting such a thorough report back to us, and stay in touch with us as well. Whatever we can do to continue to help you progress through. And we'll let you go. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Okay. What I'm going to go ahead and do is to have Deborah come forward, Smith, and and we'll get to Representative Ledoux's bill just shortly after. But
well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'll be hopefully fairly brief, although I could go on for quite a while, because since 2002 we have been attempting to increase our close working relationship with the state on many different levels, both the investigative and prosecutorial. On almost every priority of the Department of Justice, we've been working very closely with the state. The first would be on anti-terrorism. The U.S. Attorney General Ashcroft directed that each district in the country have an anti-terrorism advisory council, and that the Department of Justice chair that. What we did with that in Alaska was form the first state-federal anti-terrorism advisory council in the nation. And that we have a memorandum of understanding between Governor Murkowski and the U.S. Attorney's Office. It has developed to where it's being used as a national model, and in recent conferences, both at the Department of Homeland Security and at the Department of Justice, the model that we developed jointly with the state is being touted as an example of what small districts should do in an attempt to coordinate their interagency response to prevent terrorism or to respond to it. The way it's set up, basically, is there's an executive committee of the Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council. The state attorney general is on it, as well as the U.S. attorney. It's co-chaired by the U.S. attorney and the commissioner of military and veterans affairs for the state. The commissioner of public safety also participates. There's a wide participation on that executive committee by the head of just about every federal, state, and military agency in the state that would be involved in a terrorism response. The executive committee directs a group called the Joint Coordination Group, which is a deputy-level group, which again has full participation of, for example, the first assistant U.S. attorney, as well as the individuals at the state level. And for example, the director of the Homeland Security response within the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs participates. And we have broad state participation at that level also. There are many other working groups on this advisory council, including an intelligence advisory group that actually on a daily basis coordinates the intelligence of 14 different agencies here in Alaska and shares that intelligence. We're also working closely with the private sector on infrastructure protection and developing the relationships there that are essential. As I say, it came as somewhat of a surprise to us to suddenly be touted as a national model, but I think it speaks really well to the coordination between the state and federal that we've developed here. Moving on to criminal areas, though, the second priority of President Bush and the Attorney General's has been since 2002 reducing violence in our streets and in our neighborhoods. The initiative has been called Project Safe Neighborhoods. And we've done a number of things of an interagency nature here in Alaska in response to that initiative. We have monthly task force meetings that include the District Attorney's Office, the Attorney General's, as well as state agencies, the troopers, APD, to discuss how to approach various problems that are around as far as gun violence, federal crimes as well. They also meet, though, on an every two-week basis to determine of those emerging cases which ones should go federally and which ones should go state. And this is one of the first times on a routine institutionalized basis we've been making that determination. There's several benefits for certain types of cases for cases to go federally as far as enhanced penalties that may not be available at the state. And there are also other advantages and potential benefits on occasion from going federally. What that does, though, is increase, obviously, the resource drain on the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is a very small U.S. Attorney's Office, since resources are frequently given out based on population. We have a very, very small U.S. Attorney's Office. What we've been doing, though, as we've increased this interagency working together, is cross-designated assistant district attorneys to work on various issues at the federal level and out of the U.S. Attorney's Office. The primary example is probably in Project Safe Neighborhoods, some grant money has been provided, federal grant money, to further the efforts. And we have used that in this district to pay the salary of an assistant district attorney who's cross-designated and works out of the U.S. Attorney's Office on federal firearms prosecutions. And that enables us to take more of those cases that we otherwise might be restricted from as far as not having adequate resources. Additionally, some of that money has gone for different types of projects, like looking at some probation reentry issues and assisting the troopers as far as if Commissioner Tandeski is still here. No. As far as some lab work, funding one person at the lab level for firearms work in that way. There's a new initiative within the Department of Justice to further focus Project Safe Neighborhoods and the concern about violence onto anti-gangs. and to really hone in on those folks who are creating problems in our neighborhoods through the development of gangs. In this district, we had great success in the mid-90s with what was called Project Safe Streets, and that was again a joint federal-state project. Troopers were involved in that throughout the investigative period. And a great number of emerging gangs were broken up, and the individuals and leaders in those gangs were imprisoned. They are expected to be re-entering society in the next year or two. And so that's one of the challenges that the various task forces see as far as keeping Alaska safe, is responding to that. So we are continuing to use the same model we have in Project Safe Neighborhood as we determine where the additional funding we receive for the anti-gang initiative will go and how we'll use that in an interagency way.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
I want to compliment you. Tim, I've met him once, real tall, right? Tim Burgess.
Tim Burgess, right.
Tim actually came out when I first was elected and active, you know, in the community, you know, but a lot of you don't, you may not have in Fairbanks the community council structure that we do in Anchorage, which is really neat. It's neighborhood folks get elected and then they advise for the community. And out in Muldoon is the largest community council in the municipality of Anchorage, the Northeast Community Council. And he came out and he presented that talked about that program. And we were kind of like you coming here. It was like, geez, you know, I mean, the U.S. attorney actually came and spoke. So I think that's good. And I recommend it, as short-staffed as you are, to try to keep doing that, not to every community council, but to the big ones. Because, I mean, there was about 30 people there, and we were like, whoa. I mean, everyone kept the packet because it was like it made it a little more serious.
You came to Mountain View, too.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
And the crime mapping that we used for the presentations to the community councils were some of the funding from Project Safe Neighborhoods that we devoted to crime mapping. And interestingly enough, and then that allowed us to also assist in the development of various weed and seed sites, which is another federal Department of Justice program, where we were able to extend the Russian Jack, the East Anchorage site, to Russian Jack, and working on Mountain View as well. And the crime mapping was fascinating for us because you could see street by street where the most call-ins have been to the police department for gun-related offenses. And when some of the community councils did surveys, there was a real disparity. I'm digressing, but it was an interesting thing to note that the people who lived in the neighborhoods with the highest rate of call-ins for gun violations were unaware of it. You know, when you went door to door and did a survey, what do you see the biggest crime problem to be? They would say vandalism, not realizing they were like in the state of Alaska's hot street for gun violence. I guess because they weren't home when it occurred or something, I don't know. But we found that to be fairly interesting that you know, there was a need for additional communication with the various citizens in those areas to even know what challenges they were necessarily facing on the crime front. There is another concern that we have been working jointly with state enforcement officials on, which involves child pornography or child enticement via the internet. This is a much more serious problem in Alaska than we had ever recognized previously, or perhaps it's just growing as it's growing everywhere. But the Attorney General has just recently in February announced another initiative to tackle this called Project Safe Childhood. In Alaska, we were out ahead of that national effort and had in 2004 made it one of our district's highest priorities to tackle. There is a very effective and one of 40 in the nation, a task force here in Alaska focused on internet crimes, cyber crimes involving offenses against children that has a lot of state participation in. This is another area where we probably do need to talk more about further cross-designation because I could probably devote as many resources as we could devote to it. I think we will probably find that many cases are there. We have historically worked jointly with state prosecutors and attorney general, assistant attorney generals on environmental violations, and continue to do that now, again, through cross-designating them and them working on grand jury investigations we may have underway, as well as on the civil side. State assistant attorney generals work very closely with representatives of the environmental enforcement section of the Department of Justice. And we have cross-designated two drug prosecutors, two assistant district attorneys in Fairbanks to assist with drug prosecutions. That's another area that our resources are tasked, and it's an assistance. It's great assistance to have help from the state there. And I think you mentioned the community outreach that we've been focusing on and the weed and seed sites. And I think that sums up at least as far as I can.
What have you taken on? You need more.
We do.
Thank you so much for your impromptu update, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Smith, do you believe there are any legislative changes or anything that we need to be doing at the legislature, at the legislative level, to assist in this effort? Hmm.
Well, Department of Justice policy really prohibits me from advising on state legislative matters.
As an official, I'm asking you as an observer.
As an observer? As a citizen of Alaska.
Next up, that says someone can petition the court, the state court, to, if they think they're innocent, to have their DNA tested if they pay for it. That's not federal, but you mean things like that.
No, I mean just... As a citizen of Alaska.
As a citizen of Alaska.
I
really think a lot of it comes down to resources. And so any opportunity and any legislation to expand the resources available for both investigation and prosecution, I would heartily endorse.
Through the chair, do you see any impediments to the full and complete cooperation on both sides?
Both sides being?
Federal and state.
No, I think we have an outstanding degree of cooperation here. And
I mean any institutional, not personal problems. I'm talking about anything we can do to make this easier. I mean anything that's there that we can remove. I mean, I'm now flipping the question around.
Well, through the chair, I would say, Representative Gruenberg, that it, again, comes down to resources. If you know, more can be made available and more cross-designation can occur, you know, then we can, on a, you know, a very broad basis, make a determination when it's best for a matter to be handled federally and when it's best to be handled in the state and not be restrained by expense.
Just a final read the report.
Just and wrap up, mm-hmm. Representative.
Just a final question. You mentioned that you have a very small office because it's based on population. Two questions, actually. Could you break down how many civil lawyers and how many criminal lawyers you have in your office?
We have approximately 20 lawyers and approximately 12 work exclusively on criminal matters.
Is that the fact that it's based on population, is that written into federal law?
No, and I should expand my comments there. They do consider other matters, and in the last 5 years, we have been receiving, whenever Congress provides additional positions, Alaska has been receiving them.
You know, you get a lot of good volunteers too. The summer between my first and second year of law school, I spent under Jim Torgerson in your civil division, and it's a great trade out because it gives you guys a little extra helping hands, and then it obviously gives the person on the other end no money, but just the experience of working in your department, which is really good.
Thank you for letting her speak.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Okay. Without further ado, House Bill Number 325 by Representative Ledoux, post-conviction DNA testing. I have, after the bill's sponsor... The sponsor's representative presents the bill. Who is presenting the bill?
She just walked up.
She just went to go get
Oh, we'll take a brief at ease and wait for Gabrielle. Judiciary is back on the record at 3 o'clock, and we've been joined by Representative Ledoux to tell us about House Bill 325. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thanks very much. I'm Gabrielle Ledoux, representative from House District 36, and I want to introduce my aide, Kimberly Wallace, who is going to present this bill.
Great.
We'll speak in Russian.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Kimberly Wallace, staff to Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. Before you is a blank CS version 24-LS1222/I for HB 325, dated April the 1st, 2006.
Chair, do you want to adopt that for
discussion? That'd be great. Representative,
I move that we take up as a working draft this version I, dated 4106.
Is there an objection to that motion to adopting the CS? Hearing none, we have the CS before us. Please continue.
This is an act relating to post-conviction DNA testing and amending Rule 35.1 of the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure. Currently, 40 other states provide convicted persons access to DNA testing. The handout before you, prepared by Legislative Research, dated February the 1st, 2006, shows a sample of states that have adopted legislation pertaining to post-conviction DNA testing within the past 5 to 6 years. The Innocence Project states that since 1989, over 170 people imprisoned in the U.S. have been proven innocent through post-conviction DNA testing. The intent of HB 325 is to improve the Alaska criminal justice system for all Alaskans by providing a statutory right to DNA testing. Specifically, this act establishes a procedure for application for DNA testing and the appointment of counsel. This legislation can help free an innocent person and let law enforcement and the public know that a guilty and dangerous person is still at large. One of the handouts in your committee packet is an article from the Ketchikan Stories in the News, dated March the 6th, 2006, by Representative Anderson. In the last paragraph, Representative Anderson states that one of his top priorities as a state legislator is expansion of the DNA database. On page 4 of version I of HB 325, lines 9 through 11, the testing laboratory is ordered to make the DNA available to the DNA Identification Registration System and to any other law enforcement DNA databases. Our office has collaborated with the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Law, the Innocence Project, and members of this committee to make HB 325 a better bill. I'd like to direct your attention to the format and content changes to HB 325 as outlined in the memo to the committee members from Representative Ledoux, dated April 4th, 2006. If you would like me to go over the changes, I would be happy to do so at this time.
What is the committee? We've got it all.
You don't need to.
Laid out.
You can just go.
Okay. So for the record, there's a memo regarding the CS work draft and the changes.
In conclusion, I'd like to mention a Scientific American Mind article that was also included in your packet. On page 26 in the bottom left-hand column, the article states that typically 20 to 25% of DNA exonerations had false confessions in evidence. This begs the question, why would anyone admit to something they haven't done? The article continues on page 30 to note the psychologist to note that psychologists categorize false confessions into three groups: voluntary, compliant, and internalized. There have been cases where no physical evidence has linked a person to a crime, but due to a confession, they have been charged and convicted and even sometimes executed for a crime they did not commit. If HB 325 can help just one person prove their innocence and the real perpetrator to be identified by DNA testing, then we will have achieved what we set out to do. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify before you today. I know there are others who wish to testify online in the audience. This concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. So what I'd like to do is go to the folks who wish to testify first, and if you guys could stick around, one or both of you, to answer questions, then we'll bring the bill back before the committee for discussion. Okay? So next I have, why don't I go ahead and go to Trace Lewis? Okay. Cliff Stone, and then I'll go to Steve Salone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep my testimony very brief. Public safety's only concern was on page 3 under the testing payment section 12.72.230. In the original bill, Madam Chair, the DNA testing itself was going to be done by law enforcement and a correctional facility. And I think it was just a matter of language, a mistake by the bill drafter, and indeed it's the samples that you want for the DNA testing to be taken by law enforcement or at a correctional facility. And then the further language 24 and 25 refers to an accredited lab like the state lab or the Washington State Lab that they contract with. Those are the proper vehicle to actually do the DNA testing. So it was just a matter of verbiage, and we wanted to clarify that and be on record.
Okay, so you're comfortable with the CS now?
Yes, yes.
Questions? Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Stone, when my staff and I discussed this, I had some of the same questions. So you're saying now that under the CS, the collection is should be performed at a law enforcement or correctional facility, the testing done elsewhere. Now, but I have a question of just a technical thing too. I misread this. On line 23, the word performed, when you collect something, you don't perform it. It probably should state collection of samples shall be done. And Madam Chair, I misread this thing, and I'm going to offer an amendment, and I don't know if it's appropriate to do it now, just for
wait
ease.
Wait until after the testimony.
Okay. Well, I will move at that time.
Do you have comments on that, Mr.
Through the chair, I couldn't agree more with Representative Gruenberg, because when I first looked at it, something made me hesitate, made me hover right in that same area, and I just couldn't quite come up with the right language, but I knew there was something wrong with the way the drafter had. So you're right on the money.
And I have another question too. Then the next sentence, testing, and I'm going to go through this a bit with either him or Ms. Wallace on other things, but the second, this whole section I had some questions about. Quote, testing shall be performed at a lab operated or approved. Okay, so it doesn't necessarily have to be at a DPS lab. It can be one that's approved.
One that's approved, and the only other lab that's approved right now is a Washington State accredited lab that we send our DNA testing out to.
Now, the rest of my questions relate to the remainder of that paragraph about who pays. I think I should ask Ms. Wallace that question rather than you.
Ms. Wallace or Ms. Carbonetti through the chair.
Thank you very much. Further questions for Mr. Stone?
Of course.
Okay, hearing none, thank you for your testimony. Okay, next I'm going to go to Steve Salome, then Trace Lewis, and then wrap up with Annie Carbonetti. Okay, Steve.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Stephen Salome. I'm the policy director at the Innocence Project in New York City, and I'll make my statement brief, but I first really do want to thank you, the committee, for hearing this bill, and in particular the chairs and sponsor, Representative Coghill. Thank you. Court review of DNA evidence discovered post-conviction has proven the innocence of 175 people incarcerated for serious crimes, thus freeing those innocents and enabling the justice system to pursue the actual perpetrators of those serious crimes. Through the National Conference of State Legislatures, I've come to know of Alaska Representative Anderson's work on DNA and his role as a champion of the use of DNA to enhance the accuracy and effectiveness of the criminal justice system. This is another opportunity to do exactly that. President Bush, Senate President Frist, and Speaker Hastert are all also committed to ensuring that innocent people are not convicted of crimes they did not commit. This was demonstrated through their leadership and passage of the Congressional Justice for All Act of 2004, which encourages states, through the power of the purse, to allow for post-conviction DNA review and to preserve evidence. The Innocence Project is extremely pleased to know that Alaska is considering legislation to join the other 40 states that have created a statutory avenue for consideration of DNA evidence after a conviction. Such legislation ensures public confidence in the criminal convictions, the public safety, and justice itself. No one benefits when an innocent person is convicted of a crime. Not the victim, the police, the prosecutor, the legal system, nor the public. The only person who wins is the real perpetrator, who is protected from prosecution by the mistaken focus on an innocent person. House Bill 325 is a fantastic step to provide exactly that justice that Alaskans deserve and is being adopted around the country. The Innocence Project endorses this bill. I would like to point out one provision, however, that might prevent this bill from having the intent that it so clearly means. And this is on page 4 of the draft, lines 13 and 14 in the definition section. Definition of actual innocence. It currently reads that actual innocence means clear and convincing evidence such that no reasonable juror would have convicted the defendant. Now, if testing is contingent upon a judge's determination, now judges in the first place are loath to substitute their judgment for that of the jury. The jury decides the facts, the judge decides the law. Here we're asking a judge to substitute, to say that with a pretty high standard of convincing evidence, no reasonable juror, basically no reasonable Alaskan of any persuasion, would have convicted the defendant if this DNA showed a different result or came out not to be that of the perpetrator. And we have numerous cases. I mean, so many of the 175 DNA exonerations were later challenged by the prosecution saying, hey, I still have eyewitnesses that said they saw this person at the crime, even though the DNA proved that the person wasn't there. That's one small example. I can provide more, but this provision can provide kind of a fatal flaw to this bill. And I would recommend that in order to bring it in line with the standard used in virtually all of the other 40 states that allowed for this testing, something, a simple change that might do that would be to say, actual innocence means that no reasonable jury would have convicted the defendant. Now, and that would even be a slight compromise because most other states use the standard of if there's a reasonable probability that the jury would have come to a different conclusion had they been able to consider this evidence before providing a verdict. And you can see why that's useful, because what you're trying to do is say, well, we didn't realize that the DNA offered this proof before trial. And geez, if the jury knew this, what do we think they would have done? If we think that if a jury knew that this excluded the defendant, would they have, is there a reasonable probability that they would have come out to a different conclusion? That really is the ideal standard that is used in almost all other states. And that, because what we're talking about here is not setting someone free, we're talking about whether or not to test the evidence. And in simply, which would then determine whether or not a new trial should be granted or some other form of relief. So, the Innocence Project is very thankful for your efforts. We appreciate this bill very much, but we're extremely worried about that definition, and we hope that you would consider an alternate. I will end it with that, and I would welcome any questions you have.
Representative Bloomberg and then Anderson.
Sir, I did not catch your last name. Would you please state it and spell it for the record?
Certainly. I'm sorry. My last name is Saloom. It's S-A-L-O-O-M, as in Mary.
And Mr. Saloom, to get back to your proposed language, and I assume you have the proposed committee substitute in front of you there?
Yes, I believe so. It's
the I version up in the top right-hand corner.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, looking on page 4, lines 13 and 14,
yes.
Do you want to delete the phrase clear and convincing evidence?
Well, I I believe that would also be appropriate.
Why?
Because if you relate it back to where this term is used, which is, let me get to the page in section 10, page 3, I'm sorry, page 2, the second to last line of page 2, line 30, 29 and 30 says, the court may not order DNA testing unless the petitioner shows by a preponderance of the evidence that, then you get to the next page, it says one favorable result of DNA testing could demonstrate the petitioner's actual innocence. So there's already a standard set in there, which is preponderance, and then actual innocence as a new standard, which is clear and convincing evidence.
Well, it sounds to me, if I may, that what they're talking about, it's probably not well drafted, but it sounds like the standard for at least the rest of section 212 must be shown by a preponderance of the evidence, but that the actual innocence must be by clear and convincing. It's sort of a dual standard in there. And I don't know, and I'd ask Ms. Ledoux, Ms. Representative Ledoux, Ms. Wallace, at some point to explain the dichotomy there, because that seems pretty confusing. Unless there's a good policy reason for doing it, it is not often that in a lawsuit there are two different standards. The only case I can think of where that occurs is in an adoption, where you have to terminate by clear and convincing evidence, terminate the parental rights, but you show that the adoption itself is in the child's best interest by a preponderance of the evidence. I'm not aware of any other circumstance where you have in the same motion, and this is in a motion, that you'd have two different standards. And I could see good policy reasons for requiring the whole thing to be by clear and convincing evidence. But I'm going to ask you, and then I'll ask them the same question through the chair, why should this, or any part of it, be by preponderance of the evidence rather than clear and convincing? And I think the members understand the difference between those standards. Do you? No, it doesn't. Okay. Preponderance of the evidence, this is for some of the members here, means more likely than not, 51%. Clear and convincing is not to the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, which excludes all reasonable doubt to the contrary, but it's a standard in the middle. And it's a very high standard. It's, as far as I know, the highest civil standard. And with that, Mr. Saloom, why should this or any part of it be by a preponderance of the evidence rather than clear and convincing?
Well, you know, I will say that, I mean, if you wanted to clarify and simply put in that, you know, numbers 1, 2, and 3 under 210, that the favorable result would demonstrate the petitioner's actual innocence, that the evidence is there, and that the testing wasn't available beforehand, that's something, it's really a policy decision here. The reason that we believe that preponderance of the evidence is the best standard to use at this point is because, again, it's just a question of whether or not the evidence should be tested. And I don't think if you have an innocent person in prison, and you need, well, we should recognize that in the 175 of the nation's DNA exonerations, a jury had already found all those people guilty beyond a reasonable doubt on all elements of the crime. So there is the ability to kind of overestimate the other evidence that exists. And if you set a high standard for even testing the biological material that could be tested, to provide new evidence, you don't give yourself the full benefit. You certainly don't give a potentially innocent person in prison the opportunity just to say, look, this proves it. This proves that I'm innocent. If you will simply test it, then you will know. And certainly if it comes back to identify the person as the source of the material, then it's case closed. You don't even have to go any further, and we don't have to drag it through the court system. But an early burden at that point in the process, when the person, you know, when innocent people have been convicted for crimes they didn't commit, we know that, is an inappropriate thing at that point in the process. So that's the reason I would give.
I, Madam Chair, I'm not totally sure that subject is exhausted, but I'm going to vacate the field on that, leave it to other members of the committee. I'd ask you to consider whether you have further questions on that. That's one of the central issues here.
Questions? Okay, further questions for Mr. Saloom? Okay, hearing none, Mr. Lewis.
Madam Chair, if Mr. Saloom can stand by in case we have further questions.
Mr. Saloom, are you available to stand by?
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Representative Anderson. Steve, thanks.
Me.
Well, that's okay. Just thanks for. I had other questions, but I'll defer. Sorry. But thanks for. It must be 7:30 there, huh?
Yes, sir.
Is American Idol on? Who got kicked off?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I'm actually in the train station in D.C.
Jeez, thanks, Steve.
Representative Anderson, my apologies. Do you want to?
No, oh, that's okay.
Mr. Lewis.
Deal with that later.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Trace Lewis. I'm a private investigator here in Juneau. I've been in private practice for 21 years. I'd like to make some quick comments about DNA. The 1980 was when DNA became a word in the criminal system. People started to say, hey, we can do this. It was in 1988 that the FBI started to do their first testing. It was a very controversial process for a number of years until they straightened out some of the databases that they used to produce the statistics. It was in 1998 that they started to actually put this information into a data bank called CODIS. I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but it's where the results of the tests are actually stored. But I also note that it's actually, I think it was in 2001 that they really started to get involved with mitochondrial DNA. Now, mitochondrial DNA is, of course, the DNA that is through the mother's side. And a lot of evidence that's collected at crime scenes is not really suitable for any other kind of testing other than mitochondrial DNA. One of the things that I'd like to point out is that the hair on an arm without a root is not really good for any other type of testing other than mitochondrial DNA. Now, I'm aware of a case that I had where the individual has now served his sentence, who I'm personally convinced was innocent. Had mitochondrial DNA testing been available, it might have been able to be improved. It was the hairs that were involved, and they were similar to his, but he claimed they weren't his, and I think there was other evidence there that would also support that. He was convicted. He's since served a sentence and has been released. But had this statute been available, he could have had that particular DNA tested, because it was not tested, and if mitochondrial DNA had been available, it could have been tested. So, in summation, somebody could be sitting in prison where this type of testing now is available, which was not available at the time of his conviction, could indeed have his conviction overturned with DNA testing that's now available. So that's kind of a historical context and why I think this bill is important. The other issue that I'd like to talk about is, as Representative Gruenberg mentioned, is the dual standard. And I thought that the preponderance of the evidence standard, I thought, was more appropriate. There are still some hurdles that an individual has to jump through before the biological samples can be tested. He's already probably exhausted all of his appeal processes. He's already probably gone through a lot of those kind of things, and the only thing left to him is an attempt to prove his innocence through the testing. And so I think that it's appropriate that the standard not necessarily be so high to give him an opportunity to attempt to prove his innocence through the DNA process. And the other area that I had comments on was also been discussed, and that's the dollars and cents. And I kind of did a quick sample of testing costs just through private labs on the internet. I'm certainly not exhaustive. I saw test prices running from $125 to $1,500. Some tests going so far as to being able to determine the eye color of the individual who the biological sample came from. So there are some things that can be done that I think are probably very realistic, but I think the costs to the state in this program, we may be talking about several hundred dollars per sample. We may not be talking about thousands and thousands of dollars, and so I don't think it should certainly be the money side of this would be something that should be considered. Those are my comments. If you have something else or questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Cockett.
Since you've looked into it, Trace, the development of the CODIS is one thing, but what about the development of the science? Have you had a chance to look at the increasing capacity, or in your view, having looked into it from an investigator's perspective, that the science has become more and more reliable, or is it there bigger, more questions? Because I think if we're going to start tilting on this, the reliability of the testing might be something we need to look into a little further.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, the testing started out originally was the first type of testing was called RFLP, which became known as the DNA fingerprint. Shortly after thereafter, the development of the next form of DNA was PCR. Again, I'm not going to try to break down the acronyms, but PCR originally started out with just testing six positions in the DNA. They're now doing PCR tests, and I believe the crime lab is now doing 13 positions in the DNA. And so the testing is becoming more and more discreet and more precise. And I think that there will be other forms of DNA testing that are developed. And so I think the test has become more precise. Let me backtrack for a minute. I've dealt with a case with an ancient science that everybody for years and years and years thought was absolutely reliable, and that was dealing with the analysis of the content of lead, being able to match a bullet found in a decedent to a box of bullets found in the house, and saying the bullet came from that box of ammunition. Well, I was been deeply involved with that area for a number of years, and that now the FBI has quit doing that testing because it was unreliable science. They no longer will do that. The National Academy of Sciences said, you guys were wrong, this can't be done. That kind of testing went on for 30 or 40 years, put many, many people in prison. They're now reversing convictions in the United States over just this lead bullet analysis. However, do I see that as an area that's going to happen with DNA? No. The reason I say that is that the science involved in the early development of DNA testing was very fundamentally sound. And I think that there's a tremendous, and I think as the science continues, it has become more and more accurate. I think that eventually they will be able to tell us many wonderful things with DNA, and I think in terms of the criminal justice process, I think DNA is a good, solid science for both the conviction as well as the release of the innocent. Again, I'm aware of a case, I can't speak to it terribly specifically, but a man that was facing being charged with a very serious felony. It was the direct result of his attorney negotiating with the prosecutor to have some of the evidence tested for mitochondrial DNA, which proved that he was not present. It was not his hair. And he therefore was not charged. And they're still trying to figure out who was there. So I think that this whole process is very fundamental to the criminal justice system, this DNA testing. And I think as a forensic science, I think it has become more important than many of the other forensic sciences when we're dealing with various crime scenes and who was present, who was not present. Hopefully that answers your question, sir.
That's helpful. It opens up an interesting dialogue. I suppose we're not going to close here.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, Annie Carpinetti.
Thank you.
name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And we agree with Representative Ledoux that this is an important issue, and it's an important bill. And we've worked with Representative Ledoux and her staff, and they've been wonderfully cooperative. They've taken several of our suggestions, and we appreciate their cooperation. Unfortunately, still, however, we have serious reservations about the substantive provisions in the bill in its present form, and we'd like to be able to work with you and her further, if possible, to come hopefully to a position where we could be closer together in terms of what we think the standards should be. The bill would establish circumstances where a person convicted of a crime could obtain post-conviction DNA testing. And the goal of the testing is, of course, to undermine the conviction that the person had suffered. There are two principles here that are important, and one is one important principle in our criminal law is the importance of the finality of criminal convictions. And you got to remember that a person who's asking for this post-conviction DNA testing has been convicted by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. He has had an automatic right to an appeal, and the appeal, his conviction has been affirmed. And at the same time, the victim of the crime is trying to put closure on the experience that she had or he had, and to move on. And we should also remember that the Alaska Constitution now gives a victim of a crime the right to the timely disposition of the case following the arrest of the defendant. And opening it up again for post-conviction procedures is tough on victims. And our job is partly to protect the victims. The United States Supreme Court has found that finality in criminal convictions is essential to the operation of our criminal justice system, because without finality, the criminal law is deprived of much of its deterrent effect. Having said that, we, of course, agree that there are certain very rare cases where post-conviction DNA testing should be done if a person who is truly innocent has been convicted wrongly. But the problem is, how do you write that in a statute to catch the truly innocent person without allowing defendants who are convicted and who should be serving their time and moving on from bringing repetitive requests for DNA testing? First of all, and we have some global problems with the bill in its current form. We also have some minor technical drafting problems. For example, the burden of proof. It is not clear by those two provisions that you raised. Of course, we think that a person should prove by clear and convincing evidence that the testing should proceed. I know that the Innocence Project is on the other side, but you know, this person has been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt and has had an appeal. At this point, to bring a civil action, we think that he or she ought to establish by clear and convincing evidence that post-conviction testing is appropriate.
Madam Chair, you want me to hold my questions?
It's up to you. Annie, what do you prefer, questions throughout or at the end?
Oh, whatever you prefer is fine with me.
Oh, why don't we just ask that now, since we focused on that. I'm going to ask you the same one-word question that I asked them. And they kind of gave a conclusory answer, and so have you, really. Since this is at the heart of much of the real litigation on this issue, will be this burden of proof, burden of persuasion. I mean, the burden of proof really has two aspects, the burden of going forward and the burden of persuasion. Burden of going forward is who carries it, and the burden of persuasion is what's the level you have to prove. And I think we all agree that the petitioner, the prisoner, has the burden of going forward. I don't think there's any question about that. And Mr. Saloom, if you disagree at some point, I want you to say so, but I think we all agree that the burden of going forward is on the petitioner. But I really would like you, Ms. Carpinetti, and then Mr. Saloom, if appropriate, to hone the real policy issue as to what the level should be. And by the way, parenthetically, the desire for a victim not to have to testify again, I realize that's a necessity, but that to me is far less important than the issue of guilt or innocence. And that's a policy basis I feel fairly strongly about. But I invite you to convince me otherwise, too. But, you know, anyway, on the burden of persuasion, why really convincing, clear and convincing?
Through the chair, the person who is asking, who is applying for post-conviction DNA testing, has already been convicted. He has, he or she has had the right to an appeal. Assume the appeal, the appellate court has affirmed the conviction. At a certain point, you have to say this person has had his or her chances. And if you want to go back and challenge a perfectly valid conviction, in most cases, the person ought to be able, ought to have to bear a pretty high burden of proof to show that it's appropriate to challenge his conviction at this point, after conviction and after appeal. All of our post-conviction reliefs, our post-conviction relief statutes in our state now, for every other type of post-conviction relief, requires clear and convincing evidence as the burden of proof for factual matters. And that's why it should be here, because this is another form of post-conviction relief.
I'm going to, if I may, I'd like the members to look, did you have something on this point? On page 3, lines 6 through 9, to me, that's the heart of the reason why you might not require clear and convincing. And the reason is because there's proof that the DNA test results were not available prior, and that the reason that the petitioner didn't secure such testing was because they were not reasonably available, or for reasons that constitute justifiable excuse, ineffective assistance of counsel, or other excusable neglect. I want to divide the question, Madam Chair. When they are not available, to me, that's an easier question. And that, in and of itself, is persuasive, would seem to me to be persuasive, to say in such a case, a preponderance of the evidence should be sufficient. Do you want to convince me I'm wrong on that one, and then we can go to the second portion, which is more difficult?
It's really hard to discuss these issues in a vacuum when they are not available. We have people who are there are very few cases where it was not available at the time, because we're talking about, I mean, at least for our state, which is a fairly new state, we don't have people who are bringing these applications that I'm aware of, that there wasn't DNA testing or at the time. There may be, but...
So it's a very rare case.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the people bring these applications saying they want different DNA testing or more sophisticated DNA testing than was available, or they say they didn't get it at trial because their attorney had a good reason not to ask for it.
Well, then that comes to ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right, exactly. But that's a
That's a different question.
That's a different
question. And I realize we're sort
of... Go ahead and just stop you guys here, too, and say that what I'm going to do on this bill is create a subcommittee, because we're kind of on a deadline with House bills. And if this bill does have a chance of getting through, it's going to need some serious work, heavier lifting than I think this committee can do at this time. Representative Ledoux. So what I'm going to do is appoint a subcommittee to include Representative Gruenberg, Representative Anderson, and the third, I am kind of looking to Coghill, Wilson, or Cott to see who would have the time, interest, and so on.
Including staff.
Be on it. So I'm looking
for... Well, I have wandered into it already, so what? Unless you have a burning desire to get involved in it, Pete.
Burning desire, Pete?
Burning.
Not burning?
Burning.
Burning?
Good.
Would you like to be on it?
I'd like, love to be on it.
Okay. So let's put Representative Cott as the third person on it, and Coghill will pop his head in from time to time when he's... not working on all the other issues that we've delegated to him. And so what I'm just, and the reason I do that is that I don't want you to get too far out there, because I think a lot of this could be handled in the subcommittee. And I'm hoping that you'll work with Annie Carpinetti.
Could you be the chair?
Yes, and I'll appoint Representative Cott as the chair, and work with Gabrielle Ledoux and see what of these issues can be handled. And then I'd like you guys to, it's a bit of an aggressive pace, but I'd like you to be able to bring to me the results, if you could, next week.
Monday.
Yeah, because Wednesday's fine. That's fine.
I just want to say one word.
Representative Gruenberg?
There is a key thing, and I'm looking at Ms. Wallace here. There's a difference in the drafting of this paragraph. Results were not available on 6, not reasonably available on 8. And I'm wondering if we need to focus on that, too. I just want you guys to think about that.
I agree. That's not clear. I mean, there are several things that are not clear in this bill that we don't understand.
Maybe you could make a little list of them and distribute them to us all.
Sure.
Thanks.
Sure, I'll be glad to.
Okay, and we were just talking about it. It is Easter break next week, so if you guys could target Monday, that would be better than Wednesday, if you can. I know that's a bit aggressive, but maybe some of this can be done via teleconference or, you know, whatever method will help as the chair decides to speed it up. But like I say, if we're going to have any chance at this, we're going to have to do some heavy lifting. Okay, so with that, do you want to just complete your testimony, Annie, for the record? And let's get that into the record, and then let's go ahead and cease on the questioning part. And that will conclude, unless there's anyone else in the audience to testify, I'll ask that at the end and in the audience, and then we'll conclude public testimony.
I just wanted to flag for the folks that the other section I have questions about is the section that I was dealing a few minutes ago with the Department of Public Safety about, and that's the rest of the language, page 3, lines 25 through 29 on the payment of the cost. And Mr. Saloom, maybe we could arrange it so Mr. Saloom could be available by speakerphone, because there's the New York language that we've been given here that is in the packet. And you might, Ms. Carpenter, have an interest in this, too. It's a little memorandum from Mr. Saloom, actually, to the troopers, the legislators, talking and looking at the language that New York did on this, which looks like good language to me.
Representative Coghill.
I'm just wondering, based on some of the comments that have come forward, if there's a need to proceed on testimony. I think it could be significantly different next time we go around this.
Yeah. Why don't we do that?
Yeah. And we took his testimony for today, but you'll have his numbers or Representative
Yeah, we you've got
well
it.
As
we
can
well.
Do all this. Okay, so continuing, Ms. Carpenter.
I'll try and make it as short as possible. We suggested to Representative Ledoux, and she did incorporate part of our suggestion in this draft, that that the applicant for post-conviction DNA testing should be required as part of the application to submit an affidavit swearing that the applicant is factually innocent of the crimes he was convicted of and any lesser included offenses.
Madam Chair. Just on that point, you got a guy who's in for murder or something. Mm-hmm. You have an affidavit. Mm-hmm. He gets another couple of years on a perjury charge. I think, at the very least, we should make sure that put something in that any conviction on the perjury has got to be consecutive or something. Otherwise, there's no penalty at all.
Mm-hmm. There has to be some risk, some reason for somebody
we can sort of flag
to do this, but. And our reason for wanting an affidavit of factual innocence is that you should save these post-conviction relief applications for cases where the person is claiming true actual innocence and not some sort of technical or procedural problem with the conviction.
Absolutely.
And the Osborne case is probably a good example of this. And I passed around a copy of the decision. We're litigating in state court and in federal court. And the Innocence Project is representing Mr. Osborne, I believe, in the federal case for post-conviction DNA testing.
Madam Chair, is this up in the Supremes now?
No, it is not. It was up to the Court of Appeals, which sent it back to the Superior Court in the state. And in the federal court, it's the federal district court dismissed the application or the cause of action, which was a 1983 action. It was that dismissal was appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which reversed that, and now it's back in federal district court on a 1983 cause of action.
And they haven't tried it in Superior Court yet. They haven't finished this.
No, they haven't finished it in Superior Court. But Mr. Osborne was convicted of kidnapping, 2 counts of first-degree sexual assault, first-degree assault for his crime. He and his co-defendant kidnapped and raped his victim, beat her to a pulp, strangled her to a point where she lost control of her bowels, shot her, and left her for dead buried in the snow in a remote, kind of lonely area in Anchorage. In addition, there was really strong evidence placing Mr. Osborne in the car at the time of the crime. In addition to the victim identifying him, his co-defendant also identified him, not at trial, but because they were tried together, and neither of them testified. The defendant himself has admitted his guilt to the parole board in some detail in his application to the parole board, and I'd just like to read it to you because you should know what we're litigating and what type of cases we face when we're dealing with these issues. It was in response to a question by a parole board member saying that, and this is her question, yours was a very brutal crime. Brutal. Besides the fact that you raped her, hit her in the head with a gun, you shot her, then covered her up with snow with the hope that she wouldn't be found. I mean, that's truly brutal. And this is his response. Yes, ma'am, but the incident, and this is under oath, I understand that the incident was written, how the incident was written and how it was played out in court. The incident didn't exactly play out like that. We didn't. Nobody tried to kill Mrs. G. I mean, the reality is, if we wanted to kill her, we could have. We were out in the middle of nowhere there. It was dark, and there was nobody around. You know, it was outside the city limits. So if we really wanted Mrs. G to be dead, she would have been. She claimed she was shot in the head, and that's how she got the scar on that was on her head. And that scar came from the fact that when she was in the car, and it was after me and my co-defendant had had sex with her, she was in the car, she was nude, and my co-defendant, I had stepped out of the car, and my co-defendant had asked her to get out of the car, and she wouldn't get out of the car. Her reason for not getting out of the car was because she was scared. She thought, you know, that now that sex is over, we are going to get her out of the car and kill her. And I can understand her reason for that, but the reason we asked her to get out of the car is because we want to go. We didn't want to try and give her a ride back into the city. That wouldn't have made, you know, that would have made no sense. But he had asked her to get out of the car, and she refused to get out of the car, and he asked her like two or three times, and when she refused like that the third time, he hit her in the head with the gun, and the gouge that she had on the head came from the butt of the weapon, the butt of the handgun, and that's how she got the mark on her head. She said she was, and then it's indistinguishable. And I would also note that Jackson's oral testimony and application, written application to the parole board also admitted these facts. He, like Mr. Osborne, tried to put the more serious part of the crimes onto each other, but they both admitted that they participated in the crime. And he admitted in his written application for parole in more detail, he admitted to having kicked her in the head and kicked her around the stomach when she was lying in the snow. We think under these circumstances, under this admission, this person should not get testing for DNA post-conviction. So, and we think that a person who under these circumstances does this should not. I know that the Innocence Project has information, and they claim that factually innocent people do, under some circumstances, confess to the guilt. In those circumstances, there should be no reason why that person should not be willing to make an affidavit saying that they are factually innocent of the crime and explain why prior admissions of guilt are not believable or should not be relied on.
May I make one brief statement about that?
Sure.
It's just to say that there's one thing to talk about the factual innocence, but when you say factually innocent of that or any lesser included crime, they're just two separate issues. And that's just the only thing I want to add in there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruber?
Yeah, and I'd invite the committee's attention to page 4, lines 13 and 14, the phrase would have convicted the defendant. I think we have to be specific and look at the subcommittee, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Would have convicted the defendant of the crime for which the DNA sample is sought.
Yeah, yeah, that is an issue. And I do recognize, Ms. Carpinetti, that challenge that you have. And I understand that. And I'm hoping you guys can strike a balance. It's devastating both ways.
We also suggest that the bill include a requirement that the defendant's attorney submit an affidavit explaining his or her reasons for taking the approach to DNA testing that they took at the trial level. And the Osborne case is also a good example of that, because Mr. Osborne was represented by an attorney, a competent attorney, who made it the tactical decision not to pursue more sophisticated DNA testing in order at trial. It was available. She could have ordered it. She made the decision not to because the DNA testing that was done, which was not very sophisticated for the even at the time, put him in 14% of the people in of the black race that could have done the crime. And she wanted, and she submitted an affidavit saying that in connection with this case, she wanted to be able to argue that that's a big group that he mm-hmm. could have come from. She chose not to obtain the more sophisticated testing, which was available, because she was, first of all, afraid that it would inculpate him further. Second, she wanted to be able to make that argument. So, and in all our PCR applications, when it is based on ineffective assistance of counsel, which is a little different from this, the courts require the applicants to submit an affidavit from the trial attorney explaining any tactical sure. reasons, or in the alternative, saying why they couldn't get that affidavit. And that's something that, you know, some people, you know, some lawyers are gone, they're dead, or they've moved on, and you can't get it. But we think that if you can, you should be able to.
Madam Chair, I totally agree. I think that we've got to really flesh this thing out so that if the defendant's going to open up the door, then the trier of fact has to know all of the circumstances. And Ms. Carpinetti, I'd invite you to really look at this and come up with some language that you can submit to us that does accomplishes all of what you're talking about. And Mr. Salum, if you have any thoughts on this too, because we don't want just one side to be heard. We want the truth to be found.
Thank you. I'll do my best to get that to you as soon as possible. Hopefully by tomorrow morning.
That's
your
okay.
time.
I'm just looking for the probably the most the biggest concern we have with the draft in its present state is the test on page 3, lines 1 and 2, which would allow post-conviction DNA testing if the applicant shows that favorable results of the DNA testing could demonstrate the petitioner's actual innocence. First of all, I don't think that's very clear what could demonstrate means, but we think that they should have to prove that DNA testing requested would conclusively prove that the person is innocent, not could possibly. This language allows a person who has been convicted, whose conviction has been affirmed, to go on a fishing expedition saying, you know, I want this tested because maybe it'll show one thing or another. If at this point in their prosecution of the crime, they should have to show that the DNA, if it results in the way that they hope it will conclusively show them to be innocent, not
Representative Coghill.
And that's one of the parts that I was in. So, but Will was so conclusive the other way. So I don't know what kind of ground we find. Maybe we take the preponderance of the evidence and ratchet it up, if that's what has to be done. But I think you still have to allow for a possibility. Now, maybe some of the suggestion on here was whether they made themselves available for testing before, now that testing is available from here on, but that may not help us with those where it was not available. And so I was looking at some of the language in here that we might want to ratchet up there, because I understand the problem. I don't want necessarily the fishing expedition, but I don't want the bar so high that if you have to be, if it has to show absolute the will, I thought that was too high. So maybe some of the conditions that the subcommittee would come up with would say that if there is a refusal of DNA testing, even in the time when it was available, that would preclude that. So, I mean, I think there are probably steps you could go to get that, but I still think that if under the genuine innocence issue, mm-hmm. That it could show that, I think you should be able to do that. So I want to defend it a little bit, but I understand that because of the other areas, I think you have a problem. And maybe could isn't the only word that could be used there. But uh-huh. And then the other thing, Madam Chair, is I would ask the subcommittee to look on page 3, line 6. When we're talking about testing not available, we're talking about here test results were not available. That could be a technical snafu, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
My staff and I discussed the word could on line one. I generally think I support could. And the reason being because at the ultimate trial, the prosecution has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, it's a civil action, the motion itself, and the burden of persuasion shifts to the defendant to prove, at the very least, by a preponderance of the evidence. So it's not just the standard, it's that it's a complete shift. It's way over here in the criminal case when they go back to a retrial, and here we're putting it over here, and, you know, even if it's a preponderance of the evidence, it's way away from where it'll be at the trial. So that's why I was thinking this. It's almost like, and this isn't a very good analogy, like on an appeal, it's like a motion for a new trial. But it's at the trial court level, but it's the same as an appeal. You want a new trial. And it's like if you've had a summary judgment rendered against you civilly and you couldn't take the case to the jury, you're just asking for a chance to take the case to a jury. And it's not, you know, you're just getting a chance in front of it. So that's why I was thinking on the other side. I think the New York, I'm not sure if the New York model is could or not. I think maybe, yeah, it is could. That's what they do in New York State.
And finally, we think that the applicant for this post-conviction testing should exercise due diligence in bringing his or her claim. The Court of Appeals said that they thought that those provisions and other post-conviction relief statutes should apply, that you shouldn't just be able to wait till, excuse me, other witnesses are lost or they've forgotten and then ask. Once you know, you should have to exercise due diligence in presenting it to the court.
Doesn't rule, what's the, is it 35?
35.1.
Does not that have a due diligence standard in it? It's been a long
Well, the
time.
Statutes, AS 1272 have due diligence. The statutes have specific requirements for when you have to bring a PCR, and then there's exceptions for cases where exceptions should be recognized. But even in the exceptional cases, for example, newly discovered evidence that's discovered after the timelines in the statute.
Like Salinas or Salazar standard? Salinas was the standard.
I think you're correct. They still have to exercise, even if they come in with one of the exceptions from the deadlines in the statute, they still have to exercise due diligence in presenting it to the court, because otherwise you have, you know, witnesses moving away, and then the whole reason why you want to uphold the finality of judgments, you know, you just
it's in everybody's interest, the victims and society.
It's in everybody's. Sure. It's even in the applicants, I think.
Absolutely, to have certainty one way or the other. Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody online? Okay, so public testimony. We'll close on House Bill 325. We'll go ahead and refer this to the subcommittee with Representative Cott as the chair, and look forward to any changes that they can make to bring back to us next week. Thank you, Representative Ledoux. And this is in no way a stab at you or anything or to make you feel badly, but it's just because of the unusual time crunch we're under, I think it's the better way to try to get your bill moving. Okay, so without further ado, we are adjourned.